You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, HRN has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila. Delicious and smooth tequila, meaning harmony with the earth. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. It's Tuesday, June 21st, 2022, and we're here in the studio in Brooklyn, New York, Heritage Radio Network. Okay, so it's that time of year. There's been so many great beer and food books coming out, and we've got to finally get our hands on Wild Brews by Jaeger Weiss, and I'm loving it. Not just the photos and the story of her, but also the style of beer, wild beers, lambics, and other things that we haven't talked about in a while. So really looking forward to having this conversation. We have two great guests with us. Jaeger, if you just want to say a few words about yourself.
Hey, everyone. My name is Jaeger Weiss. I'm the head brewer of a brewery called Wildcard Brewery, and we're based in East London, in the UK, you probably add.
And Jeff?
Hi, I'm Jeff Lyons. I'm the brewer and owner of Endless Life Brewing in Brooklyn, New York.
All right. So, Jaeger, let's tell your backstory. So, I love the intro to your book, Wild Brews. You talk about the Midlands. What is it about the Midlands? You know, we're here in the States, and I know one reason you're on is because your book's now coming out in the USA. The Midlands and beer, and your first time at a camera event.
So to put it into some context, so I'm from Nottingham, so we're probably the most famous for what Robin Hood is probably why most people around the world will know us for, but we're also round the corner from Burton-on-Trent, which is quite a famous kind of beer city in it's more of a small town, really, in the UK. And it's just like the beer there is just excellent. But when you grow up in that environment, like sometimes you can take it a bit for granted. So I talk about in the book about the, I didn't even come to beer until my kind of like late teens, which I don't know about the US, but in the UK, that's certainly quite late. I went to my first beer festival, well, proper beer festival, which was at the Loughborough Polish Club. And it was a camera beer festival. And I tried a pint of Harvest Pale, which is a brewery in the UK based in Nottingham. And it was 3.8%. Very, very pale, very quite bitter, and compared to kind of like soft multinational lagers, it comes across as exceedingly bitter, but it has this really lovely like citrus edge to it. And I didn't know it at the time, but I was kind of trying one of the best beers in the country, and that beer then went on to win basically best beer in the country GBBF, which is the Great British Beer Festival. If your beer gets crowned like best beer at GBBF, it is like you can expect it, the orders to come flooding in the next day, basically. It's a huge deal. And it really kind of all really started from there, really. I was homebrewing with some friends at the time. And that's when the real love of beer came. But I didn't really start brewing professionally until much later. But I was kind of messing around with my friends, really.
Well, that's a great intro. And Jeff, I met you first as a home brewer. You know, it was kind of the roots of also New York City craft beers, so many home brewers.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about what the scene was like in New York for home brewers, you know, let's say in 2010.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think I met you because you allowed your back room of Jimmy's 43 to be the BJCP meeting place for the New York City Homebrewers Guild. and some friends outside of that who joined the classes. But yeah, I think that there were so few commercial breweries in the five boroughs in New York City that most of the people couldn't get jobs. So we all spent a lot of time homebrewing, getting pretty serious about it, and just had a really tight-knit community based off of that before the laws changed and more breweries started to open up.
Yeah. You know, Jacob, one reason I love your book and I wanted to feature is that, you know, the homebrew movement is such an important part of craft beer, and I'm glad you said that. And now in particular in this country, Julia Hertz, who is a huge educator, now she's running the American Homebrew Association. So you're right in step with everything we want to talk about in beer, because everyone talks about hard seltzer and the big, you know, deals happening with larger brewers. But honestly, it's still about homebrewing, and I'm sure you must get excited when you do that still, don't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, what's really interesting is I don't really view them separately. Does that make sense? So I view it just like little brewing. Does that make sense? Okay. So it's how I trial a lot of my like complicated recipes. Like I brew at home all the time with pots and pans. I don't view it that separately. Like the procedure is certainly on my kit, because I have a very simple single infusion kit. At my brew house, like it's pretty much the same procedure. So for me, like the hygiene is the same. A lot of the techniques are the same. So for me, and I spend a huge amount of time working with kind of like local, like homebrew chapters and stuff, because for me, it's absolutely vital if you want to nail like really hard brand new styles you've not made before. I'm quite lucky in the fact that I've been doing this for quite a while. So like commercially, I can have a go at most things, but sometimes you really do need to really go back to basics and on a small scale, especially when you're working with flavor combinations and you're working with like different fruits and you want to know how much do I have to add? How much do I have to dose? Do these fruits even go together? I think doing it on a small scale really is key.
No, that's true. And Jeff, for you too, so many of those homebrew meetings all over, whether it was New York City Homebrewers Guild or some of the ones you were part of in Brooklyn. I mean, what was one of the strangest things you've done in a homebrew? Did you ever have a pine needle beer made or something else that was a feature of a meeting?
Oh, man. Honestly, no. I've always been exploring different yeast, different mixed cultures. I haven't done too much craziness in homebrewing. I'd have to jog my memory a little bit to think about some of the weirdness that I've seen at the meetings. I have a buddy who made a sriracha beer. He took a saison and split it up into 1 gallon batches, and he did all sorts of nonsense to it. Hot sauce and sriracha and all sorts of weirdness.
Yeah. So, Jake, I love that you were talking about that. Tell us more about that homebrew scene that you have access to.
Oh, it is. It's quite intense here in the UK. So there is a big event now, actually, called BrewCon, which is kind of where it all culminates. And in fact, this last year, they hosted it at my brewery and a brewery opposite called Hackney Brewery as well. So we're part of we've been in a part of the London for quite a while called Walthamstow, and lots of the other breweries have recently moved. So there's kind of a long stretch of breweries in a straight line, which is only like 10 minutes walk from each other. And BrewCon was held there, and it's just so exciting. It's so exciting being around that energy. We're talking like must have been like low thousands of people who come to this festival, and it has everything for sale you can imagine in the homebrew community. Lectures going on. You've also got homebrew competitions going on at the same time. You've got professional brewers coming in and giving talks. So it's really exciting to be around that kind of energy. And I've been there lots over the years, either giving lectures or just attending, and it's just so much fun. it's just so much fun to really geek out with people, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. So when you studied science in school, just tell us about that. And did you think originally you would become a brewer?
You know what? No, is the honest answer to that question. So I did chemical engineering, right? And I didn't realize the whole time that I was secretly building a beer career without realizing it. So step one, I came from the Midlands next to Burton-on-Trent, which is already like, that's kind of like Mecca for beer in the UK. I did chemical engineering. I then went and worked in water treatment for a year and a half in a lab where I learned not everything there is to know, but I worked for a company called General Electric, which is a big US company, their water division. They made us go to water school, which I'm not joking, where I learned just everything about like hardness and how to soften your water. Just basically all the information that I use every day now. And then I went into chemical trading, buying and selling chemicals, which is not really very related. But then I just quit my job with no plan and then got a job in a pub, which taught me the cellaring side. And then a few friends who I used to homebrew with back in the day, just really mess around with. They're like, you know, dude, we're thinking of doing that brewing thing we always used to talk about. And I was like, yeah, go on. Okay, I'll help. And then that was 10 years ago. That's pretty much what happened, really. I just never left.
That's the way to do it.
Jeff, I can think, yeah, like, why not learn about water, right?
Oh, man, it sounds incredible. I'd love to go to water school.
maybe that's your next book, Jaga, Water School.
Oh, man.
But it's one of the reasons why in the book I spend a lot of time talking about water, because it's just so vital to what we do. And it's probably one of the most underappreciated ingredients. And we have such a massive variety of like hardness and alkalinity levels here. And I know brewing beer in London is really, really challenging because our alkalinity levels are super high, which is really, really good for making like porters, but shocking for making things like lagers. So having to work with it in a way, and also we don't have on our kits, we don't have ion exchange or reverse osmosis. So you have to figure these things out chemically. And knowing what to adjust and how to adjust it, I feel like it's taken me my whole brewing career to really get it right. So I kind of figured if I was going to write a book, I may as well just put the things I know in the book. So I was hoping to make it useful for both commercial and certainly for home brewers, but certainly like it would have its place on a commercial shelf as well. And not just theory, like practically, like you need to add a bit of this and a bit of that in order to get this. So that was, yeah, that's probably why I focused so much on water, because it changes your beer so much, right?
Well, so like, and we know Burton-on-Trent is the home of IPA, and some of us know it as Bass beer if you're not into craft. But how is the water at Burton-on-Trent different from the water in London?
So it's actually, the water in Burton-on-Trent, right, is really, really unique. And if you ever get the chance to come to Burton-on-Trent, just have a pint in a pub, like there is nothing fancy in Burton-on-Trent, like at all. So if you come, I'm sure you'll be excited by the beer, but the surroundings, okay, I'm going to be polite. But it's incredibly sulfurous in Burton-on-Trent, and there is something when you brew with it and you go to the pub and you have a pint, there's a smell and a taste that locally in Burton they call the Burton Snatch, which is a really strong sulfurous, like matchbox quality to almost all of the beers, but it's like it's just incredibly unique. And I would say if anyone gets the chance to try it, that they should.
Well, that's a new one.
Yeah.
Jeff, had you ever heard of that or anything else about Burton-on-Trent?
Pretty much that, and that's the extent of my knowledge, yeah. Yeah, the Burton-on-Trent, the snatch is always a good joke. Yeah. I'm curious. I'm curious with that water quality. I've never thought how that relates to making wild beers, sour beers. Do you find that is it advantageous, or is it something you have to overcome?
So I have always treated my kind of wild and sour beers with the same rules that I would in terms of water treatment wise, in terms of for every other style of beer, if that makes sense. So if I want more body, I may change my like chloride sulfate ratio. That's how I've always done it, if that makes sense. And I'm sure lots of people have lots of different ways to do it, but I purposefully didn't go into if you want this kind of sour, you need to have this water treatment, because I just don't think that's true. I think a water treatment generally should be treated as a try it and then amend as you go, if that makes sense, or amend for next time, because I think it makes such a big difference. I think it depends on the overall what you're going for. So if you're after a beer that's quite clean and quite crisp, you might do one thing. If you're after a beer that's rounder, fuller, you might do another thing. So yeah, that's probably quite a wishy-washy answer. but I would say the same rules apply as they would in all brewing, in all areas of brewing, really.
Yeah, we're blessed in New York to have such incredibly soft water. There's almost nothing in it. And so I was just curious.
Really?
We've done exactly what you talked about using those proportions to shift it one way or another to alter the perception. But we've never had to think about stripping things out because it's hard water or there's too much particulate in there. So it's just something I've never thought about. It's interesting.
How would you find brewing the darker style beers?
I think that you just add a little more to it, right? It's pretty easy to do, but instead of worrying about stripping things out, you just think a little bit more about what you're putting in. You might add some more, you know, bicarbonate or something to boost it up a little. A lot of people put like cornstarch or something of that nature in there.
Yeah. I just find the whole area just so fascinating. And I think it's one of those things where, especially homebrewers, I think it's one of the biggest areas that is generally taken for granted. But I would say the key is just knowing what's in your water. And 9 times out of 10, most breweries know what's in their feed water. So just to all the homebrewers out there, just please wind up your local brewery about it, because they will probably give you that information like for absolutely nothing. And it really is the beginning of really improving your beers.
Jenga, is there a kit where you could test the water
that you're
running at home?
Oh, there is, but I'd probably say it's probably a bit prohibitively expensive for a home brewing scale. When I used to work in water treatment, it was something that we used to have. We used to have kits that used to test every single parameter, but not one that did it all at once, if that makes sense. And they're quite small, quite simple kits, but we're still talking like £60-70 a kit, if that makes sense. I don't know what that is in dollars. That's probably like,
yeah,
it's probably $60-70 a pound is it's not doing that great. But I would just say I don't know what it's like in the US, but in the UK, our local water source will tell you what's in their feed water, roughly. So you should be able to take it from that. But it's honestly your local brewery. They probably get it tested once a year, once every 6 months anyway, and you're likely to be taken from the same water source. So I would say just ask them, or just tweet them or Instagram them. I'm sure they'll tell you.
Oh yeah. So Jenga, There's some really great recipes in the book. How did you start gravitating towards wild brews?
They're just really nice. I think it's the is the key thing for me. Now, you know what it is? Like, I'm so lucky that I live like a train way away from Brussels and from Belgium generally. And they make just such incredible beer in Belgium. It's just such an inspiration to be able to not only go there, but in order to be able to get a hold of all of those kind of beers, I'm talking like the Cantillon, et cetera, to be able to get a hold of those beers so cheaply that we can in the UK is just, it's just the inspiration is just through the roof. So it's one of those things kind of as my career has progressed, you kind of start by thinking, okay, well, I'm going to try and I need to master cask beer, I need to master bottle beer, what's next, IPAs, dark beers, et cetera, et cetera. It's kind of the natural progression is to try and get really, really good at the beers you admire, right? So I've been working for a long time on my barrel aged beer program, and I really wanted to do it like sour, like lambic sours, Gerses, and to do like the imperial side. So like dark, rich, 10, 11, 12, 13% dark stouts as well. And it doesn't hurt that if you can make really good kettle sours with fruit in them, they sell really well. They sell really, really well. So if you can make a beer that looks like bright red or bright purple or like bright orange or what have you, it's like commercially quite a smart thing to do. So yeah, just the love, really. The love in Belgium is the inspiration.
So in your book, what's a good first sour recipe to start with that's in your book?
So I would say one of the simplest ones to do, I've actually got a copy of it here. One of the simplest ones to do is to start with, it's probably to start with the Saison. So the Saison with like the kettle sour method. So I've literally put basically one of the easiest methods you can do, which is basically adding a bit of live yogurt into your beer in order to turn it. Because obviously live yogurt will contain a lactobacillus, which will give you a nice gentle lactic sour. And then you can add some fruit in there later to try and really make it a little bit complicated. But I think it's a really nice introduction. I purposefully made the book on purpose using the brew in a bag method. So like the simplest of methods, because the whole point of this is to try and encourage as many people as possible to try brewing beer. And I didn't want to make it too like fussy or complicated. But yeah, I've done lots in here. So I've got a Kvike recipe in here as well. And then it goes, I've got Gose's, Passion Fruit Gose, Berliner Weiss, Lambics, Gerses, and that's when things get really complicated, when you have to start having years of different blends. But started super, super simple with a nice, gentle kettle sour.
Well, you know, and Jeff, you'll probably agree with me. One thing I love about talking about homebrew recipes is that we're not stuck on one style. You know, it's not like a brewery has to put out their IPA and a sour. Just the different styles you mentioned to me is one reason I fell in love with craft beer, you know, 20 years ago.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, that's part of the joys of homebrewing is to be able to just try anything, right? And then sort of go down whichever rabbit hole you want to for as long as you want to, and then pop over to another one. Yeah. It's incredible. I jumped into sours pretty quickly though, almost for the opposite reason as Jaga. You know, I'm living in Brooklyn on a very meager salary at the time and starting to homebrew and realizing, you know, how expensive it was to buy a bottle of Cantillon or anything similar. And I could make a whole batch of sour beer, 5 gallons of it, for the price of buying a bottle. So I've actually had like infinitely more of my own sour beer than any of the sort of legendary breweries.
Clever.
Jeff, what's your Cantillon recipe? Like when you were doing it, what was the recipe you started with?
So there is, was it Barrows, the Wild Brews book, that the Brewers Association put out, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago. They have a bunch of recipes in there and I probably jumped off from there, but it's something simple, like 60% Pilsner malt, 40% unmalted wheat. And if you can't get that, just use like flaked wheat or malted wheat. But really with sour beer, it's so much more about the culture that you use to ferment it than it is the actual recipe. So, I think to start, it's probably, you know, if you're going to go with a long-term sour, like you're hinting at, Jimmy, I think you'd want to just buy like maybe a mixed culture from Y Yeast or White Labs or one of the smaller, yeast providers. But yeah, you could do a very quick version, like Jacob was saying, with either, you know, live yogurt culture or, at least in the States, it's pretty easy to find, Good Belly, and you can buy the little tiny Good Belly shots. And one of those will go so far, so fast, if you're trying to just do a quick, clean sour and sort of, you know, not have the complexity of a Cantillon or similar, but just something really light and easy, but much quicker turnaround.
Yeah. And Jenga, I love that you said Cantillon because, I know that the bright colored, you know, quick sours with fruit sell, but when I think of Cantillon and the Belgian sours, it really turns me on. I'll tell you a funny, a pub owner's story. I mean, 2006, I got my first keg of Cantillon Goose, a 30 liter keg, from my pub. And I remember that in 2006, it sat for 3 weeks. Nobody wanted it. And we were tasting it and drinking it and enjoying it. And then I never got another keg again in 2014. And that literally, we mentioned that we were getting in the keg and people went through it in 2 hours. So, just seeing the change in a few years of interest in it, it take me back. So we've got all these different styles in your book, Jega. So Cantillon Lambic, and there's other things like the Flanders Red, which is Rodenbach.
Yeah. I mean,
how do you make that? You know, these are the beers that I want to drink. So I like the fancy beers. I like the expensive beers.
So what's really, really exciting about the Flanders Red, and I've spent a huge amount of time judging lots of them in competition and just like generally drinking them really. But what's really exciting about them is their acetic quality. And I talk about acetic acid, or it's more common named vinegar. I talk about earlier on in the book when I talk about Acetobacter as a species of bacteria, and about just how masterful I think being able to use it in a beer correctly, or to use it in a way where it just accents a beer and doesn't take over the profile, but really makes it so much better. In my opinion, it's nothing short of genius to be able to use it in such a fashion, and that the style of Flanders Red does it just so, 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 so beautifully. And when you get a great Flanders Red, it's like the heavens open up. It's so complex. That combination of like Brett, you've got like lactic acid, you've got you've also got the acetic, kind of all working together and playing together. It's just, and the kind of zingy tartness, plus you've got the darker malts in there, the kind of sweet, chewy red fruit in there as well. I just think it's absolutely gorgeous. So in the book, I've written about how to do it. How to do it in a couple of different ways. One of them is to cheat. I've always put that in the book about how to do it in a cheap, dirty way, because that's the way professional brewers, they always have those that knowledge. But I've also said how to do it in the really complicated, get your oak chips and soak them in wine for a long time, etc., etc., and then dose that into the beer. But obviously with your other cultures as well. But yeah, so have a look at the book and you'll and you'll find out. But I think Jeff is right. Obviously the base is important, but when you get to beers like Flanders Red, the base becomes really important. So in the book, I've got just a mix of like Vienna, light crystals, dark crystals, some wheat in there as well. So really looking to get that kind of really good body, that kind of chewy, caramelly flavour as a base, because it makes all the difference with that beer. And I'm sure you guys know just how hard it is to make a true red. So not a brown ale, like a red ale. And sometimes your beer loves to go brown, or if you use the wrong combination of malts, it goes brown. But I used to make for a really, really long time a red ale, so I know how to get the colour right.
So what's the secret? I never thought of that with Rodenbach either, for red. I mean, we don't really see, we don't see any red ales.
Really? Okay, so as an I fan, if you use a combination of light crystal malt and dark crystal malt, but in the right quantities, you will get a true red. So I've put the quantities in the book, but that will give you a nice true red. The other way to do it, obviously there are lots of ways to do it, but if you use roasted barley, it quite lightly, that can give you a nice red as well. But there are lots of other malts that you can buy, Cara Red, you can buy all sorts of other malts, but also they're my kind of two tried and tested red methods.
Jeff, have you ever made a red ale?
Yeah, about 2 months after I started brewing at home at all, I dove right in and made a red, was my first sour. Yep. Doing it sort of the long, hard way, sort of what Jacob was talking about the mix of light and dark crystal. Some wheat, some aromatic malt, I think really made a big difference in that, like about 5%. Yeah.
Well, here's my shout out to Rodenbach. I have a food pairing alert, kids. a very like upscale barbecue breakfast, and I have a good friend who used to do competitive barbecue. In the morning, when all the barbecue guys would be standing around, he would take out a nice bottle of Rodenbach, and he would serve it with head cheese or another really fatty, you know, homemade kind of charcuterie. So that's a great pairing. Head cheese and Rodenbach. Thanks to Sam Barbieri of Waterfront ALS. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes. Keep talking to Jago Wise on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
I'm Chava Periwan, co-host of Agave Road Trip on HRN, here to talk about 818 Tequila. 818 creates their tequila using traditional methods at a family-owned and operated distillery in Jalisco, Mexico. From the blue agave they grow to their recycled glass bottle, 818 emphasizes the earth's importance in all they do. Their distillery runs on biomass and solar power, which means they don't rely as much on fossil fuels and are able to reduce their carbon footprint. Their labels, corks, and boxes are all certified by the Forest Stewardship Council as coming from sustainability-managed forests. 818 is a proud member of 1% for the Planet, through which they support HRN as well as Sacred, my organization in Jalisco, where together we transform agave byproducts and water waste into adobe bricks that are donated to local infrastructure projects, like a local library in Zapotitlán de Vadillo. Visit drink818.com to learn more about their sustainability efforts and find 818 near you. 818 has been part of so many magical nights for me, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
Hey, hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. Support us and to become a member at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. So we've got a great new book in front of us, Wild Brews by Jago Weiss from the UK, and now it's launching in the United States. And Jago's with us, as well as Jeff Lyons, the brewer owner of Endless Life Brewing in Brooklyn. So, Jacob, I love this book, Wild Brews, and I'm always interested in the stories and the intro. But you mentioned you're early introduced to some beer history, and you mentioned the Tudor era, and all I say is I did look it up. So the Tudor era is like Queen Elizabeth, so let's say the 1500s. But so what was different? Why did you mention the Tudor era and beer? And you kind of mentioned souring as well.
Yes, because a lot of the beers that would have been made in kind of olden days, right? So they didn't have stainless steel. They didn't have sterilizing sprays. They were working with wood. So they were putting their beer that they produce in wood, and they weren't working with hops either. So, or largely, that they were mainly working with like a mixture of herbs and spices known as a groot. So you have a situation in which you don't have strong antibacterial properties. You're working with wood. You don't have sterilizing sprays. Like, the likelihood is the beer would have soured very quickly. So just that was one of the things that I was talking about, because I was making a TV show, and it was on Tudor beer specifically. So I got the chance to make a Tudor beer, and it was quite fun actually, making a beer with like no hygiene at all. That was quite an unusual one.
The kind of beer I would make. That's why I don't brew, Jeff, right? I have the no hygiene beer, yeah.
but it, I think it's really fascinating. I think now we are so used to clean brewing. The thought of if we're making a straight beer, if there's any sourness on it at all, we're like, that doesn't taste right, that's off. But you can imagine it would have been pretty normal to have like a small sour taint pretty much on everything that you drank, right? So it's just a really interesting place to start, really, and to look at just how far we've come in terms of brewing techniques.
And then with the Tudor beers, were they just using like grains? Were they mixing in like vegetables? I mean, what were they made the base?
I can imagine, in terms of base grain, that would have been grain they had around. So obviously it would have been barley, it would have been wheat. Probably just a mixture of the cereals that were around, I can imagine. What you find is that different households would largely have different recipes, so it's very hard to pinpoint one recipe, because this wasn't something that was seen as like largely commercial. Beer only became largely commercial when you could make money from it. I mean, like, beer equipment was passed down with a dowry, so it was largely the preserve of like women in the household to make beer. So each household would have had its own recipe. So it's quite hard to pinpoint, but I can imagine like random cereals that they would have had lying around would be the most likely source.
Yeah. And since you mentioned dowry, what was in a home brewer's dowry? I mean, was it a kettle? What?
Is there well, the thing is, one of the things that's really fascinating is, like, beer is not really changed that much. It's still the same thing. Like, we are extracting sugars from a cereal, and then we boil it, and then we add a herb. Like, it's not massively changed. So you can imagine the equipment would be very similar. We're talking, like, pots and pans. I think the biggest difference between that and the commercial brewing we do now is probably the preserve of maltsters. So we probably, at the moment now, there's a whole other industry whose job it is to make us delicious, tasty, ready to brew with grain. Back then, I'm sure it was likely that people would have had to do a lot of malting in the home. And with that, you're going to get a whole load of variations, and you're probably going to get a whole load of like flavors, especially like smoked flavors. Imagine if you're trying to malt barley over a fire or in an oven. What's the likelihood of you being able to get pale malt? Probably incredibly unlikely. Your beer is likely to be brown, just simply by the nature of toasting anything. It's going to add colour. You didn't really begin to see pale malt until really the Industrial Revolution, really. So we are talking about beer that's going to be brown, is going to be slightly sour, made with herbs, whatever herbs are around your local area. Probably slightly smoky, because just the nature of having to smoke malt. So you end up with a beer that's actually really interesting and very different to the kind of beers that we drink today. And I know that when I recreated it and I tried it, like, it was so weird, but it was delicious. It was really delicious. It like all the flavors just seemed to really, really work. I don't know how long it would have lasted because I didn't clean the beer when I made it, but it was very odd, and I would highly recommend people to try it if they ever get the chance.
Yeah. So that kind of historical homebrew, if they made it, how long did it take to ferment and to get to a drinkable state?
So I did cheat a little bit. So I did cheat and used commercial yeast. It took the normal amount of time. it wasn't particularly it wasn't particularly a slow fermenter. But honestly, we drank all the beer, so I can't say it would have stayed and it would have gone off quickly, etc., etc. But I can imagine I probably would have given it about a week the way I brewed it. But then also at the same time, there is a boil in there as well, and it does boil for a considerable amount of time. So who knows? But it was tasty.
No, it sounds great. I love hearing about all the flavors. Let's keep talking about the styles, because you know, we talk about Cantillon, Lambic, Flemish Red. Jeff, what's the style of sour that you've made recently, or that you're thinking about making?
Lambic's always been my favorite. Lambic and Goose, just something about letting a culture do its thing and really shine. And then when you get to Goose, when you're talking about blending multiple years, I mean, that just, you get to a depth and a complexity that I don't think a lot of other styles can touch on. So, I mean, that's where my heart really lies. But I'm pretty happy with all sorts. I mean, we talked about Flanders Red. That was the first one I jumped into as a home brewer, like, just, you know, thinking 2 months in that I was ready to make, you know, some complex sour. It worked out pretty well. But we mess around with some things that sort of, you know, I'd say you have probably 4 or 5 main styles of sour beer with whatever BJCP or with the whatever GABF uses to judge with their guidelines. But I think it's really fun when you start sliding in between those styles and just sort of creating things that are, you know, a little bit unique and maybe a little bit more difficult to describe or to fit into boxes. You know, letting different levels of acidity happen, letting different malt flavors come through, sort of pushing different pieces of your mixed culture to sort of highlight different fermentation characteristics.
Yeah, that's really great. Jega, just tell us a little bit about Wildcard Brewing, you know, the experience of going there, and, you know, how many of these different beer styles are on at any one time?
Oh, it's so we've got 3 bars in East London, so Walthamstow, East London. We've been there for 10 years now, so that's quite fun. So one site is just barrel aged focus. So that's called the Barrel Store, and it's where there's a big wall of barrels there, and it's got all my my current lambics in there. And other stuff, and my darker stuff as well, and my saisons and all sorts of stuff. And that's super fun. And then we have the brewery itself, which is the other side of town, and that has a bar in it as well. And we do loads and loads of quite hop forward styles, We work a lot with like Vikis, lots of saisons, and then we have a pub which we've just taken on, which is like very cask traditional, but obviously with a modern twist. But you've got to love putting stuff into cask and making brown bitters. That is incredibly fun to do and incredibly fun and tasty to drink. So yeah, we do a mixture. We do a mixture of everything, and yeah, and we're having a great time doing it, really.
Yeah. So it, you know, your first taste of real beer was a camera event, and you know, cask bitter. yeah. And now you've got a little cask pub. What is it about cask beer in your generation of English people, British people? You know, it comes and goes here. There's spots of it, but it's never really taken off here in the States.
What is really fascinating about it, I think, and bear in mind, I started out as a cask brewer, and it's the kind of thing here that's seen as very traditional, and the way it's served. So it's served at between 10 and 12 degrees. It's gently carbonated. It's comparatively warm. The beer is live. You are very much dependent on the skill of the person who's working the cellar and the pub itself. So it's kind of a harmony between the brewery doing their job and the publican doing their job as well. So there are a few issues generally, and what we're seeing in the UK now is cask is in massive decline at the moment, worryingly so. And it's the kind of style of beer that when I kind of travel and I talk to other brewers, it's one of the first things that brewers want to ask you about is how to make cask beer. And it's one of the things that it seems to be viewed quite interestingly around the world compared to how we view it in the UK. And I think the public largely here can be guilty of taking it for granted. And at the moment, cask beer is generally in a really tricky spot. And there's lots of conversations of how do we keep cask beer alive in the UK. I think the issues... No. Go on.
Oh, no, that's a great intro. Because, you know, from the Michael Jackson books that I read when I was just starting in the industry... You know, it was the 1970s, and camera came about and was saving cask. But now that's almost 50 years later. So it's neat. It's really neat to hear your take on it.
Yeah, and so you have camera who pretty much single-handedly defended cask beer pretty much and saved it from the kind of macro lager stage of like the 80s and the 90s. And now you have a situation again where you have camera who also haven't really jumped as on board with modern craft. So there's a bit of controversy over there where they've chosen to support cask and cask only with some keg, but they basically won't really get involved in keg craft beer at large. And yes, they do cider as well. So that they also do real cider. So that's a little bit of controversy there. But I think that there is a real lack of knowledge amongst some publicans. Yes. So it's happened to me many times. We get given a pint of vinegar accidentally, and the person who's serving it to you doesn't know that's wrong. So it requires a huge amount of knowledge, and we're in a situation where wages aren't particularly going up. In the UK, we have massive inflation. So are people really putting the time and the energy into training bar staff? That's probably questionable. So, but then at the same time, you can generally buy a pint of cask beer for considerably cheaper than a pint of keg beer. But we really need to find a way to put cask have it on the same journey as the rest of craft beer has gone on. It seems to be left by the wayside in a way that I don't think it should, or perhaps we need to think of better ways in order to really push it to the forefront. But there's loads of these conversations happening in the UK. I think a lot of it is probably just to generally modernise. Is cask beer cool? Do young people want to go out and drink it? Are the latest, hippest, coolest breweries doing their latest beer release in cask? I think those kind of decisions would help, but it needs some sort of an orchestrator, or it needs a trend to catch on that hasn't quite caught on yet, in order to help. So lots of problems with cask, and we are hoping that it doesn't go anywhere, because it truly is a magical style that you can't get anywhere else in the world as well, of the same standard.
Jeff, do you mind, Jimmy? Do we have a second to go on a little bit of a tangent?
Go for it.
No. I love a tangent.
You hinted at where my mind was going. I was going to ask, you'd hate to see traditional casks go away, bitters and whatnot, but would it revive cask itself if some of the more modern breweries were putting more modern styles into cask? Would it sort of prime the drinkers into drinking cask beer, and maybe then sort of they'd be more open to drinking bitters on cask? Is anybody doing that?
So there are flourishes of it. I mean, of all of the styles in the UK, I don't think the bitter is going particularly anywhere. It is incredibly popular in of all the beer styles. So it's like a bitter and like a 3.5 to 4% pale. They're the kind of two big styles. But we seem to be missing a trick of engaging new drinkers with the style. So I absolutely do think that modern craft brewers should really get on board with cask a lot more. It's one of the main reasons why I ended up going back into cask, because everyone kind of has to do their part, right? Have you ever made cask beer before, guys?
Yeah, we've made traditional cask beer. So when I worked at a brewery called Keg and Lantern, it was a brew pub, and they had a cask system when I arrived. And Brett Taylor, who's now opened Wild East here in Brooklyn, he and I were working together, and the cask program wasn't going great. We would make traditional style cask beer, and you just wouldn't go through it in the same time that you would have a couple years prior. And so you'd end up dumping it. It would go off. So just as a way, the owner was talking about getting rid of the entire program. And as a way just to keep the cask engine in, we started putting sour beer in and basically dry hopping in the cask and doing different variations, 5 gallons at a time in a pin. And it allowed, we sold a lot of that beer, and people were drinking cask style beer, but they weren't drinking the styles of beer that would normally be associated with cask. And I can't say that we ever were able to take that and then bridge it back to more traditional styles. So I don't want to put too many ideas out there and have the whole thing ruined, but I'm curious.
And Jeff and Jager too, but even back in 2008, 2009, the idea of having a beer in a cask at a craft beer bar in New York was very trendy. But again, it was anything. Like, you'd have a brewery coming in saying, we're putting our Imperial IPA in cask, and we want you to serve it next to the Imperial IPA on draft. And it didn't really say anything about the cask, and no one talked about cask conditioning.
It's all about the condition.
Yeah. But I will say that I've had them. You know, we've had some Ridgeways and Coniston's in New York, and you know there's a beauty to it. But I feel like the idea of having a cask cellar person is akin to having someone in a cheese cave that really knows how to affinage like a rind, you know, some kind of rind wash cheese, where you kind of have to keep an eye on it. And I love that. To me, that's the ultimate part of craft, is that care that goes into you know, when do you know when that cask of beer is ready to go? And you know, it does take attention. You know, you really can't just throw it up. And my argument, I want to put it out there because I've said it before, but I do feel that Guinness was the gateway away from cask, because I think you guys will probably agree with me that between the nitrogen pour that was created with that little spigot that they have, it was basically a way to industrialize and commercialize a cask style. And basically, if you had the right nitrogen mix and you had the right spout, you could pour Guinness anywhere in the world. And that might be controversial, but I do think that the kind of people that would drink cask beer, at least in the States, are right now going to a Guinness or a nitro pour and stout.
I think it's really interesting. You know what I think? I think the pandemic hasn't helped, because what you had was you had all of us breweries were left with loads of beer, because I don't know what it was like I saw what it was like in the US, but like over here we had the taps were pretty much and bars were closed pretty much overnight. So all of us were sat on loads of keg stock. We're all prepping for busier times of the year. So loads of people delivered draft beer like in the post. And you just couldn't get away with the same thing on the same scale of cask beer. It is a much, much, much shorter shelf life product. We are talking like weeks versus like the tail end of months. So that didn't help, the fact that all the breweries that made cask beer had to either throw their supplies away or try and get rid of them as best as they can. But you had a population who like literally didn't drink it probably for a good year and a half. So that doesn't help either. But hopefully we're on the on and up. We are on the up. Hopefully. onto good things, hopefully, Casper.
Well, it's neat that you've included that, you know, in your program. And I know that Jeff was making cask beer, and you know, everyone wants it. They always want it, but no one's really quite doing the work yet. I don't know if I could. I feel like if I had a cask, I'd be the guy that would forget about it and it would turn on me.
I think locally our champion is Jason Saylor at Strong Rope. They definitely have casks throughout throughout the colder months every year.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. I honestly feel that just nothing in this planet beats a pint of mild brewed and served in the like northwest of the UK and served through a sparkler, and it's like 3.8%, and it's heaven in a glass, really. Heaven in a glass.
I want that badly.
We gotta come and Jeff, we gotta get some New Yorkers over to BrewCon, maybe.
Yeah, right. Yeah, get them enthused.
See, that's something that you're really excited about BrewCon. You know what's going on in London. So you have all this line of breweries besides your own. Is BrewCon a good excuse to get over to London?
I think it's a fabulous excuse to come to London. But like to put it into context, so when I first started brewing, so we're talking like 2012, there was maybe 10 breweries in London. There's now 110 breweries in London. So that just tells you the growth of the brewing scene in this area. And you had that pattern repeated up and down the country. So there's been a real, real British brewing boom. And certainly where I brew, there's literally a brewery opposite me. There's a winemaker two doors down from me. And there are five other breweries within like minutes walking distance. So it's become a real thing to just go and hang out in a tap room and waste away the sunny days.
Well, listen, it's so great talking to Jaga. Jeff, do you have another question for Jaga?
Does any of your beer make it stateside?
Oh, not yet. I am waiting for an excuse Maybe I'm waiting for an excuse to come.
I'll have to find one.
Someone invite me to something and I'll come.
All right. I'm thinking. We'll figure it out.
Okay, and here's another one. Last one, water question. So I'm looking at the map in your book, page 39, adjusting hardness, calcium, and magnesium. This is a water question. So when you go north, there's also Scotland. Is there any connection between the water and good Scotch whiskey?
Oh, my goodness me. So right. Lots of people will answer this question both a yes and a no. So if you've ever seen them actually, if you've ever seen whiskey actually being made, like they're very, very rough with just generally everything pre-distillation. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but their ferment tends to be really open top. People are sticking their hands in everything. Like it can be quite loose at the kind of brewing side. And their aim is just literally to get a beverage that's as high as ABV as humanly possible for them to distill. But you get some distillers, especially Scotch producers, that are like on the islands or places who really want to talk about the terroir of the region. They will spend a huge amount of time talking about the different styles of water and how it makes a massive difference to your whiskey. So I think that's probably more of a controversial question than you think. you can probably go up to Scotland and find out, I think. But I've heard both yes and no in answer to that question before.
Well, that's my last plug for your book, because as you flip through it, every few pages there's something you've never seen or thought of, just like that question. So I highly recommend it. And Jeff, we're gonna send Jeff a copy. Wow, Bruce!
Oh, beautiful! Thank you.
Just a massive thank you for having me, and it's just thank you, and it's really good to chat. To chat shop with you guys.
I can't wait to read the book.
Yeah. And all right. So thanks so much for joining me. Big shout out to Armin Spengen, our engineer, and Alex Tran, our producing intern. Thanks for joining me, Jaga and Jeff. I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host on Beer Sessions Radio. We'll catch you next time on Heritage Radio Network. All right, guys. Woo! Thank you. Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.